The Source Podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. There's a deep, dark place on the internet that some call the Manosphere. It's a collection of websites, Facebook posts, and other chat rooms where men vent their rage and spew anti-woman rhetoric. Protected by the anonymity of the internet, men feel like they're free to post hateful and violent comments. These men believe they are society's victims and they need a forum to vent. But sometimes venting isn't enough, and there is violence and mass shootings. What is behind this misogyny online and in the real world? Why is it spreading? Is there a link between misogyny and white supremacy? What can be done to push back against this anti-woman rhetoric? We invite you into our conversation. Call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You can email us at thesource@tpr.org. Our guest this hour, we're joined by Alex DeBronco, a PhD candidate in sociology at Yale University who has studied male supremacist groups. Alex, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Jessica Reeves is here, an expert in from the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism and author of the report, When Women Are the Enemy, The Intersection of Misogyny and White Supremacy. Jessica, welcome to The Source.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Steve Hendricks is here, a writer for The Washington Post who has covered a mass shooting connected to everything that we're talking about today. Steve, welcome to The Source.
Thank you, Dave. Good to be here.
So, Alex, if you could tell us more about what it is we're talking about. Are we just talking about a handful of guys that just are not really good at getting along with women and they don't understand it? Or is this something that has become a social phenomenon that needs to be addressed?
Yeah, I think it's substantially more serious. To begin with, I generally don't use the term manosphere, which I feel like doesn't get at what is actually occurring. These are mobilizations. They use framing along the same lines as social movements do, about believing there is an injustice. Generally, that injustice is deprivation of male sexual entitlement. And so these are misogynist, they're male supremacist mobilizations. The incel community, which is the most glorifying of violence, is certainly the smallest one, but it has also led to attacks in which we had mass fatalities in Toronto and Tallahassee last year, and another thwarted attack this year. And the larger communities, like the Red Pill, which was started by a New Hampshire state representative, those communities have hundreds of thousands of followers online and also organize international conferences and other venues in which we see the impact of their ideology spreading politically and culturally, and in both personal and now larger mass violence.
So it sounds like you're saying these are very well-organized groups. They are putting together scripts or messages that appeal to other men. So they're actively recruiting. Is there an organization behind this?
The male supremacist forums are an element of the broader alt-right, and so it is a largely online phenomenon that then trickles into offline manifestations. There are organizations and websites that are some of the conduits for this, in addition to Reddit and other forums. The Southern Poverty Law Center focused last year more significantly on one of the major men's rights websites, A Voice for Men, which is run by Paul Elam, and they are also the group that organizes the international conferences, which have taken place in the US and the UK and Australia. and Return of Kings, Rouge V, which is the pickup artist element of, you know, there are a lot of different communities, which I think are confusing for most people because sometimes they have internal divisions, but overall their desires are still male supremacist. And so Return of Kings has also been monitored by the Southern Poverty Law Center because of the level of hatred that is espoused on those sites and by those individuals.
Jessica Reeves at the Anti-Defamation League, you're tracking all of this, and what are you able to detect?
Well, so a couple, I guess it was last year when Alec Manassian, who's a tech employee, drove his van into a crowd of women in Toronto. It was a crowd of people, majority women. This was sort of the, we had been tracking sort of misogynists and specifically incels sort of internally for a while, but this sparked sort of a conversation within the Center on Extremism here about the language that we were seeing that overlapped between misogyny and the incels and all of the online populations that Alex mentioned, that and the white supremacist groups that we are much more familiar with here at ADL. So this was sort of a new line of investigation for us. Certainly it was on our radar, but it seemed to be coming to something of a head over the last couple of years. You know, we've seen the Elliot Rodger attack. We saw several other attacks that in retrospect, you know, and in the moment, you could certainly link to incel movement. But what we were really interested in initially was looking at how white supremacy was overlapping with this conversation about women, and why were we not treating, you know, this conversation that degraded women, that minimized women, and that sort of treated women as being less than human. Why were we not the big we? Why were we not treating this with the same sort of seriousness as you know, other you know, issues facing our society, other prejudices, other you know, injustices, and you know, racism, anti-Semitism, etc. And I know that this is a commonly held concern for academics, you know, Alex included, that, you know, we need to be looking at this in a much more serious way. So there was a larger conversation that happened, and it was just really interesting for us, having much more expertise in the sort of world of white supremacy, to look at the conversations that white supremacists were having about women and how much of the conversation was similar, and how much of the wording and the usage and the terms for women were similar between, you know, white supremacist conversation on Gab and then the incel conversations that we would see on Reddit. So we actually started to track that and look at the intersections. And it was just a really eye-opening sort of intellectual exercise. It resulted in our report on that intersection.
We're talking about toxic masculinity and how it is pervasive online. Women frequently have to deal with abuse, threats of violence against them when they go online, whether on Twitter or in other forums. What have you experienced? Have people just dismiss you online and insult you online and attack you and threaten you in the most horrible ways simply because you're a woman? And why is that happening? Why is it spreading? And now it's erupting into the real world. We're seeing these attacks, violent attacks, mass shootings. Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. The source is going to continue right after this quick break. Listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about toxic masculinity and misogyny online. when this spills out into the real world in these horrific shootings. With us now is Steve Hendricks. He's a writer for the Washington Post, and he covered and he went behind the scenes, told the story about a shooting that follows right along with what we're talking about. Steve Hendricks, it was the hot yoga shooting in Tallahassee, Florida. What happened?
Well, this was in November of 2018, and about 5:30 in the afternoon at a yoga studio a couple miles from the university, from Florida State campus, evening class was just about to begin when someone who wasn't a student came up and asked to pay a spot fee to come in. A little bit outside the norm for the yoga studio that was a largely female clientele. This was a big guy in a kind of an ill-fitting t-shirt. He carried a yoga mat that was still wrapped in plastic and a plastic in a black gym bag around his shoulder, and seemed kind of uneasy and nervous. And the receptionist noted that he was unusual, but didn't note it very closely. And then he did come into the studio just after the class had begun. The dozen or so students were in a child pose, which is kind of hard to imagine, a more vulnerable position on your knees and hands with your head down. And the yoga instructor, the only one in good position to see him, asked him to take his shoes off and put his stuff in a cubby. And he just methodically took out a pair of shooter's headphones from his bag and then a Glock 9mm. The only thing he seemed to say at that moment was, "But I have a question." One or two of the people who were in that room that I talked to looked up at that moment, and what they saw was kind of a large man standing there with his gun in a upright posture, almost as if he were in a pose of his own. And then he just lowered it, and he shot the woman closest to him and then began shooting rapidly but not very precisely. He did not seem to be targeting any particular person. Obviously, there was immediate pandemonium in the room, and he just shot at targets of opportunity as they ran by and ran into each other and probably jostled him.
So let me just say that the name of the shooter's name was Scott Paul Beerley, and he had a long history of anti-woman actions. He was banned from the campus. He had been arrested for assault and had been noted for grabbing women in the past. He was had put YouTube videos online. They're still there. They were taken down, and now they're put back up. Just talking about his hatred for women and other racial minorities.
Yeah, I spent several weeks getting into his background, and his history of hatred for women actually is nearly lifelong. His first problems with this were in middle school discipline issues, and he ran for class president in high school, and the slogan was, he was running against a young female student, was, "We don't need any women being, in our class or as our class officers." And he wrote a novel. He was kind of a prolific writer of both prose and lyrics over his life. And he wrote a fairly lengthy sort of novella that one of his classmates gave to me in high school, where he describes his rage at the girls who he thought were, teasing him or belittling him or not receptive to his advances. And it's a very horrific revenge fantasy of tracking these classmates through school until he eventually murders them all. And the classmate who gave me the novel, who was in the same group, said, the names were slightly changed, but those were his friends. So his history in this world seemed almost part of his personality. He didn't get indoctrinated. He seemed to come to it from some very, very deep place, and it drove him and derailed him consistently through his life until it finally ended with an attack in Tallahassee.
Now, so let me go to Alex DeBracchio. DeBronco. In your studies at Yale University, how different is Scott Paul Bearley?
Different from other attackers, you mean?
I mean, does he have follow a pattern?
Yeah. So what I think is really significant about the Tallahassee shooting, when it first happened, it wasn't immediately reported in the news as related to the incel community. And there was speculation about what the rationale might be. But as soon as I heard that the target was a yoga studio, I immediately expected that it would turn out to be incel related, because this is a symbolic target. And he referenced Elliot Rodger in media that he had produced prior to his shooting. And Elliot Rodger was thwarted in the goal of his desire to attack a sorority because they didn't open the door. But he chose them, and he's very explicit in the materials that he produced beforehand that because he can't kill all women in the world, he's chosen a symbolic target, a sorority, which is associated with young, attractive women, which I think the yoga studio as well fits that bill. And so when attacks happen on targets like these that are associated with women, and that even though this was did not end up being the case with his victims, one of the two women that were killed by Bearley was an older woman, the intention is to target the women who they see as depriving them of the sex that they are entitled to, in the same way that when there is an attack on a synagogue or on an African-American church, the anti-Semitism or the white supremacism that is behind those attacks is something that people immediately think of. An attack on a sorority, an attack on a yoga studio, these kinds of venues are symbolic terrorist attacks in the same way, coming from a male supremacist, misogynist ideology.
You know, we had a shooting here locally not that long ago at Sutherland Springs when Devin Patrick Kelly went to the church and opened fire. He went there deliberately to try to kill his mother-in-law. He killed so many people that day, that Sunday. And he had a lifelong issue with women as well. And so is there any thinking about how his story also fits that pattern as well, Alex?
Yeah, so in addition to male supremacist movements, mobilizations, mass shootings in general are perpetrated by men. And the connection we've seen recently, there's been more and more reporting over the past couple of years about the fact that most mass shooters have histories of domestic violence, of prior violence against women, of stalking or sexual harassment or such. And so in addition to the misogyny and the ideological aspects that motivate the mobilization that we see amongst incel shooters, for instance, the role of misogyny, the role of what you referred to as toxic masculinity beforehand, the role of male supremacist beliefs and male entitlement, those are also very significant factors in white supremacist movements and in other mass shootings or acts of mass violence that happen out of this kind of aggrievement. They are being committed virtually in all cases by men.
I'm going to go to the phone lines. Number is 210-614-8980. Jeff, welcome to The Source. Thanks for holding on. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on the show. I listen every day at lunch, but I'll make this really quick. So my thought is, if you go back thousands of years ago, men were the hunter-gatherers. And as the dynamic changed and we were able to acquire food and shelter and those things without having to have that strength, men kind of lost their position. And so fear began. And then as you continue to take that through into politics and the business, into those kind of things, that fear continues to elevate. And we see that fear against women. We see that fear against races. We see that fear against religions. The same thing happened to the Jews. The same thing happened to is happening to blacks today. And, you know, we've talked on your show even about reparations and things that need to happen. And so I think that the main thing that we need to focus on is, why do we have that fear as men? Certainly, it's a little bit innate because we all have that fear of losing control. But what we have to do as citizens, as a population, educators, business people, parents, we have to help, first of all, understand the fear. And second, how do we educate young men early on to not have that fear? Because the honest truth is, 50 years ago, I didn't have to perform as well as a man over a woman, because just because I was a man, I was going to get a position. Nowadays, that's not true.
So, okay, so thank you for those comments, observation. Let me go back to Alex, if you could sort of think if Jeff brings some good points there.
Yeah, so I think it's definitely the case that the more organized male supremacist movements that we see today have their beginnings in the real, though insufficient, gains of the women's movement, and particularly since the 1990s, and Anita Hill testifying about Clarence Thomas's sexual harassment was actually a very significant and upsetting event for the growing male supremacist movement ideologies. So there is a reaction to what is, you know, they perceive or portray as an injustice, but is really the loss of their uncontested status as in male supremacy. But in terms of how to deal with this, I think that the acceptability of misogynist and beliefs in male sexual entitlement is a very significant part of the problem. There are, of course, issues with scapegoats, and anti-Semitism comes from scapegoating and a lot of prejudices, but the response needs to also think about, why is it that they feel justified in this type of response? And there's a really excellent article that talks about how the literary canon reinforces the logic of the incel that appeared in The Guardian. And this talks about the books that pretty much are on all of the required reading lists in college. It was written by Aaron Spampinato. And it talks about how the books that you would read in high school talk more about male sexual entitlement, often have portrayals of sexual harassment and sexual violence. And the books that, you know, something like Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar that she mentions, the books that would show women's stories, the books that would grow empathy for women, and books that would show consensual sexual relations very rarely appear in reading lists. And so thinking about the culture broadly is part of the prevention too.
Right. And so well, Jeff's point about there's this idea that the natural order of things used to be that men were in charge back in the day, the tribal politics, and the men were the hunter-gatherers and the women were back dealing with, that's a myth. That's not necessarily how things actually were back in the earliest days of humanity. We know frequently that there was a lot of power sharing going on, and there were times that women were the decision makers in those early societies. It wasn't until much later that as society became more male dominated and more geared toward trying to subjugate women, that myth came about. And maybe that myth feeds what some of these incels and others feel, these misogynists feel, is why they feel so deprived. But we're going to continue our conversation. We're going to come back to the phones, numbers 210-614-8980, as we talk about misogyny online, toxic masculinity, and how it has been erupting into mass shootings and violence all around us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, and we're going to be right back.
One of the hardest moments in Chicana writer Sheree Moraga's life was coming out to her mother.
She said to me, "Is how could you think there was anything in this life that you could do that you wouldn't be my daughter?" And I think that's all we need to hear.
Moraga joins us on Fronteras to talk about her memoir, Native Country of the Heart. I'm Norma Martinez. Download Fronteras wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about toxic masculinity and misogyny online. Let's go back to the phones. The number is 210-614-8980 with Dorothy. Hi, Dorothy. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for this program. Well, yes, I do think that violence in this country against women is increasing. I think the white nationalists and white supremacists have, since Trump has been in office, taken his clues and permission. He's encouraging men to assault women verbally, emotionally, and sexually, physically. Yes, I do think that men think they're losing something. They're losing their ability to control and dominate, but they're taught that. They're not looking at the world in a realistic light. They're taught that, and they're continuing that. All batterers are certainly, the vast majority of batterers and abusers, including rapists and murderers, claim to be victims. They're being victimized. They don't seem to feel like that they can compete in an equal world where people are people, whatever gender they are.
All right, Dorothy, thank you for that call. Jessica Reeves is an expert at the Anti-Defamation League's Center on Extremism, author of the report, When Women Are the Enemy, The Intersection of Misogyny and White Supremacy. Is there a political element to this? Because we heard from Dorothy bringing up Donald Trump.
Without a doubt. I mean, we are seeing, you know, after the election of Donald Trump, a lot of these message boards erupted. They were very, very pleased with this election. They saw this. This was sort of the in a way, a prototypical defeat of the striving woman. If you think about the sort of gender dynamics of the 2016 presidential campaign, Donald Trump beating Hillary Clinton was, all of their dreams come true.
But some of the messaging about Hillary Clinton wasn't political. It was just hateful.
Well, I mean, yes, absolutely. And there was so much misogyny in the campaign itself. But among the followers, I mean, there's just an unending, unfortunately, well of hateful commentary that's directed at women who, sort of dare to strive for higher office, who want to take positions of power. But Hillary Clinton probably endured some of the worst of it. And absolutely, I mean, these were not political issues. I think probably most of these men couldn't have cared less what Hillary Clinton's positions were on any of these issues. This was just unacceptable to have a woman who dared to think about ascending to the presidency. This was too much for them. So when Trump won, it was sort of a vindication for them. There was, again, just, you know, this was a, there was a gleeful response. Everything that Trump had said about women, you know, grabbing them, treating them as property, assaulting them, insulting them, preying upon them in every possible way. This was just, you know, a reflection of all of the misogynist beliefs and just a real vindication for them.
And you also write that there is an overlap between anti-woman, trying to control women, and reproductive rights.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. There's a really interesting conversation and sort of divide that goes on within the white supremacist movement when it comes to abortion and reproductive rights. Certainly there's a sense among white supremacists that white women in particular should not be allowed to have abortions because this, their primary goal and their primary function in life is to be, an incubator and is to produce as many sort of white race warriors as possible. They feel very differently about women of color, the white supremacists do. So it's this very sort of I mean, it's very reminiscent of eugenics in a way. But we, you know, we see an extraordinarily controlling response to any conversation about reproductive rights, as is the case sort of in a national political sense. There tends to be a feeling among white men that they know best and that they get to decide what happens to every woman's body. And it's, you know, what happens is based on their particular political beliefs or their racist beliefs.
Okay, back to the phones now. Let's go to Lando. And Lando, hi, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Okay.
So a friend of mine was assaulted in Austin, Texas by a public figure. The guy was almost arrested, and then he complained about it online, you know, calling my friend all sorts of names. And then she got online and defended herself, and she was just barraged with negative comments. People went onto her own personal page. They took her picture and started making memes of it. It was like toxic masculinity. But the thing was, like, half of the people that were doing this were other women. And not only were they other women, they seemed to be, like, women that would appear to be woke or, you know, who have experienced violence and experienced toxic masculinity themselves. But they piled onto her. They victim shamed her. They said that she was just looking for attention. They said that she really didn't experience violence because they know what violence was like. And it was just terrible. And this went on for a few days. So I guess my observation is that, yeah, we really got a problem with toxic masculinity, but we also have a problem with not doing anything about it. And women are actually supporting it.
All right, Lando, thank you for that. Alex, you've been looking at this from a sociology point of view at Yale University. Can you address what Lando brings up?
Yeah, so I actually, I write about misogyny for Political Research Associates magazine frequently, and my piece on mobilizing misogyny looked at men's rights activists and also at equity feminists, a term that Christina Hoff Sommers coined for her belief system. And equity feminism is a strain of kind of a libertarian ideology that asserts that, you know, women maybe needed rights when they didn't have the vote, but that we have passed through that time. And there they doubt women's stories about experiencing sexual violence or domestic violence. They argue that the statistics are inaccurate. And there also are women, you know, a small amount of them, but there are women within the men's rights movement. They're called honey badgers. There are women, red pill women. And so I think that, you know, looking sociologically and thinking about the impact of being in a male supremacist society and being exposed to the same types of ideology, it impacts women as well. And so when you see women who are participating in these kinds of misogynistic movements, who are internalizing those beliefs, who are supporting Trump in spite of the kinds of rhetoric and also the incidents that he has been accused of with relation to his own background of sexual harassment and sexual assault, that women are experiencing the same influences that create toxic masculinity, that create male entitlement, and they're being told to believe the same things about male victimization and about women as the problem. And so you can't escape that being part of the same society, even though it ends up putting women in a position of perpetuating, you know, the same culture that harms them.
There's an expression that no one's going to hold you down harder than your own kind. There's sometimes a competition for things, including approval, vastly on society. But you sometimes observe that women will attack women on their physical appearance. So Alex DeBronco, is that part of it as well?
Yes. I mean, certainly there are aspects of that, but I also would say that I think that that perspective is probably a little bit overblown, and that the focus on the minority of women who are also a part of these movements, and in some cases also what happens in the online sphere, is of course as well that occasionally men will create fake accounts that appear to be female. But even without that, the vast majority of these movements are populated by men. All of the acts of mass violence are occurring because of men. And so even while recognizing that, and certainly they recruit, they want to put female faces in some cases in front of their ideology because it makes it more seem more palatable and more acceptable. But I don't want us to be distracted by that minority and put more blame on them as on women as holding down other women, because it is the case that, you know, we live in a society in which on the whole, men are making the rules, and that male supremacism is perpetuated more by men than it is by women themselves.
Okay, so we're getting ready to take a break. The phone number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're talking about toxic masculinity and on the online with the misogyny that we see, the hateful messaging that's pervasive across the internet. Online hateful comments are largely anonymous, but they do spill out into the real world sometimes with mass shootings and other attacks. We'll hear more about what happened in that hot yoga studio in Tallahassee with that shooting with Scott Paul Bearley when we come back from this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Let's go back to the phones as we continue our conversation about toxic masculinity. And Chuck is online. Hey, Chuck, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
How are you doing today?
Okay.
Hello?
Yes, sir. Are you there? Okay, we lost Chuck. Okay, so his comment in my messaging space here says he doesn't see this happening. He, you know, he doesn't think it's a big deal. So, let me go over to Jessica Reeves with the Anti-Defamation League and just respond to that. Is this just a really small group of highly vocal people with a lot of volume, but they don't have, there's not a lot of them?
So I think it is a big deal. And I think what I always remind people is that when we're talking about white supremacy, for example, what you're seeing sort of manifested in outright action or outright speech is actually, representative of a huge number of people who aren't saying anything, who are sort of in the shadows, who are thinking and feeling and acting upon these things in small ways, but are not necessarily visible to all of us. It's the same concept behind, in the newspaper business, people always say that, you know, every letter to the editor represents, you know, some tenfold, hundredfold number of people who feel that way, but who have not taken the time to write a letter to the editor. So, you know, whether you're seeing this sort of manifested in very obvious ways in your own life or in your own sort of circle, I don't think that's necessarily an indication of whether or not this is a serious problem. We know it's a serious problem because, as Alex mentioned, you know, these are cultural issues. These are issues that pervade the entire society. We know that men dominate, you know, government. We know that men dominate industry. All the decisions that, you know, go into making women feel safe and equal are being made currently by men. So to say it's not a big issue is to, I think, underestimate the impact, the social impact of these really dangerous online groups, but also just sort of a pervasive cultural sense of entitlement that a lot of men have, whether they admit it or not.
So let's go back to Steve Hendricks, a writer for The Washington Post, who wrote about the Tallahassee shooting, the shooter, Scott Paul Beardley. Scott ended up taking his own life. He killed two people in that yoga studio. And Steve, you did some deep reporting on that. What was his objective? What was his mission that day?
Well, to kill women. I think he had talked about this in various song lyrics. He had fantasized about it in his writings. He had gotten in trouble for all kinds of physical assault in the course of his life. And he left messages behind saying, you know, words to the effect of, if I can't make this work, you know, on my terms, then I'm just going to take some of you out. And he planned it fairly methodically. One of his other obsessions was, besides yoga, was teen cheerleaders. And there was a internet search history he had of teen cheerleader pornography, and then more specifically cheerleading camps in the area. He actually made a trip across Florida to Panama City at the time of a major national teen cheer camp with a gun that's known. And then he didn't do anything. It was about 2 months later that he actually pursued the same sort of course to Tallahassee. So the investigation was very thorough, and my reporting took a long time, and I don't think there's any question that he simply wanted to express his rage in the most physical, widespread way he could. He only killed two women. That was in part because he wasn't particularly good at what he was trying to do, and he was attacked. There was a counterattack in that room by the one male person who was there, giving a lot of women a chance to escape. But his goal was to kill.
And was it a suicide mission for him? He thought he was not going to get out of that studio.
I think that's safe to say. When the moment came, he cleared a jam in his gun, and the room was effectively empty, and he just put the gun to his head and ended it right there. I assume that was his plan. He wasn't wearing tactical gear or any of the things we might associate with someone who planned to fight it out and get away.
Were there any opportunities along the way? Because he was known to police. His website had been reported to the FBI. Were there opportunities where he could have been identified and he could have been prevented from having a gun?
A number of them. One of the things that struck me as I got into this story was how many times he had come to the attention of authorities for his behavior, starting with his middle school principal. But he was run out of the Army for misbehavior towards women. He was fired from a series of at least three substitute teaching jobs for viewing pornography at work, for inappropriately touching students. He was banned from the Florida State campus, as you said, for groping women in the dining hall, all three of whom were wearing yoga pants. In each case, there were complaints and consequences. He had been banned from many a bar in his hometown in New York, and banned from that campus. But they always stopped short of criminal prosecution. There were various diversions, a lot of drop charges, a lot of victims choosing not to pursue. So what seems to have happened was everything was just below the level of seriousness that would have landed him a serious criminal record. And therefore, whatever cursory background checks, for example, school systems would give to a substitute teacher applicant, didn't pick up on this history. And he just managed to skate through increasing his rage and his behavior until he did what he did in last November.
And really quickly, Jessica Reeves, do you think that is a systematic issue that could be addressed, that we can we could make the bar more appropriate, so when people do exhibit this type of behavior, that they do attract the notice of law enforcement and maybe they can't get the weaponry needed for mass shootings?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's just a systemic issue that, you know, we've seen outlined again and again and again, that these, you know, assaults against women, you know, need to be taken seriously. When you grab somebody, you know, against their will, that's an assault and it needs to be treated that way. And, you know, The Atlantic has a big piece out this month about the lack of prosecution of rape cases stems from the fact that police officers don't believe women who come forward. And this is all part of the problem. I mean, it's part of, you know, the misogynistic systems that feed into, you know, women's health and safety not being taken seriously. If any one of these cases had been, you know, pushed to its logical conclusion against Beerley, there's a possibility that he never would have been able to get the gun, or at least he would have been on some, you know, he would have been known to police and there would have been more attention paid to him. And quite possibly, you know, if the system really worked, he, you know, would have spent time in prison. So, you know, this is absolutely a systemic failing. It's something we see again and again and again. And, right. You know, people always say this is just stuff that people are saying online. Well, no, it's not. It's a predictor and it's an indicator.
Okay. And but looking upstream at like what leads to men with these issues, Alex DeBronco, can you talk about, I mean, we have these individuals who are essentially lost. They don't understand why they don't fit in with society, and they find these scripts basically online and these thinking points, and they fall into that. And next thing you know, they're in these male supremacy groups and they believe that they're the victims and all that. Is there anything else out there that can maybe provide better, more healthy guidance for individuals so that they will have a healthier understanding of what's going on?
Yes. So the impact of online radicalization, yes, it's very similar to what, for instance, happened with Dylan Roof coming across false information online about black on white crime. The alternative is the feminist movement. There is a gender justice framework that speaks to women and men and genderqueer people, and that is set up to reach actual equality. That's not what they're looking for when they're online, though. And so I think the preventative measures, it's not only about the existence of other ideologies being out there.
But they're being radicalized online. And so, like, we have a message from Kelly on Twitter. Many public schools have begun offering young men of character clubs to promote a number of things, including learning to respect themselves and women. So these are men who maybe they need to understand that their way of thinking is poisonous. It's we say toxic. It's toxic to them and to everyone around them. So Jessica Reeves, maybe at the Anti-Defamation League, how can we counter program against the male supremacist groups?
I mean, you know, that's the million-dollar question. I think, you know, raising sons who talk about how they're feeling with their parents, who are not afraid to be, you know, open and honest about what's going on in their lives. I think parents being incredibly vigilant about what their sons are doing online, and daughters, but, you know, in this context, sons. There's an amazing piece in the Washingtonian magazine in May, written by a parent whose son, whose 13-year-old son, sort of got into some of these incel sites, incel message boards, and sort of got into white supremacist, the white supremacist movement that way. And it was basically a lesson on pay attention to what your kids are doing online.
All right. I want to thank you, Jessica Reeves, Anti-Defamation League, Alex DeBronco. She was a PhD student at Yale University, and Steve Hendricks is with the Washington Post. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies, produced by Kim Johnson and Dallas Williams, with production assistance provided by me, Ruben Garcia, and Jan Ross Piedad. Dan Katz is TPR's news director.